Well, thank you, Martha, and thank you all for coming. I want to give my usual disclaimer, which is that I have a hearing problem. I can't hear out of my right ear, and so I can't tell how loudly I'm speaking. So if I'm speaking too loudly, which is unlikely, let me know. If I'm speaking not loudly enough, please do let me know also. Okay. I want to, first of all, acknowledge my co-authors on this, Joel Yeager, who is a psychiatrist, vice chair of the Department of Psychiatry now at Colorado. And Joel figured that a study of corporate executives might be the best way to explore psychopathology. So he joined the study. And then Richard Santos, professor of economics, for obvious reasons. Richard's from South Texas and participated in most of the interviews that we did. In terms of acknowledgments, this study actually is out and now in a e-publication in Sociology of Health and Illness, if you'd like to look it up, or you can let me know if you'd like a copy. There were some funding agencies that were involved, and I just want to mention the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center for Health Policy at the University of New Mexico, which is actually doing important work on recruiting people from underserved and usually minority backgrounds into health policy work, especially in the social sciences. And if any of you or any of your students are interested in that, please let me know. These are some of the other colleagues who participated. I want to also acknowledge the respondents who were interviewed, as well as several colleagues who gave helpful advice. And some of this work is actually noted in my new book, Medicine and Public Health at the End of Empire, which considers both the national and the international implications of health policy at this particular period of our history, and it's important, in my opinion, to stop and notice that this is a critical moment in history. The potential collapse of the world capitalist system and also the collapse of imperialism as we've known it, with massive involvement of people in resistance to the kinds of models that we've dealt with historically worldwide, and I just wanted to acknowledge that, and that we see this work as part of that effort. So just as background, managed care continues to play a major role in cyclic attempts to privatize and to marketize public sector and health programs worldwide. This is actually a cookie-cutter approach that involves the taking of public sector trust funds like Medicare, Social Security, and so forth, and moving it into the private sector. This has been done around the world with under the auspices of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, and now it's coming home to roost in the United States as well, as we know with tax on Medicare and so forth. Examining the economic and ideological underpinnings of managed care might prove helpful for that reason. So let me just say that in terms of the socialist aspects of this session, that there's a famous theoretical debate that contrasts the economic versus non-economic motivations of economic behavior. And this debate has actually not impacted work in health services very much. So our research actually, it was a little bit funny to look back on it because we actually thought that in some modest way we might contribute to this debate that's been going on for, probably 200 years now, which is the most important motivator of economic behavior. So we're looking at decision-making by executives of for-profit corporations that provide health services for public programs in the United States, such as Medicaid, and the views of government officials who work with corporate executives in administering Medicaid and similar public programs. In other words, we decided, as C. Wright Mills advocated, to study up rather than study down, that is to actually try to figure out what motivates the high-level decision makers who make decisions about Medicaid and other public programs. And just in terms of classic economic theory, as you well know, in mainstream economics, financial self-interest is viewed as the cornerstone of free markets and advocated for. However, Adam Smith, who's usually referred to as the so-called father of classical economics and free market models, actually, I had the opportunity to reread The Wealth of Nations as part of this book, and it's quite amazing because actually Adam Smith spends much of the book talking about the problems of free markets, in particular the way it generates poverty and inequality. He was a moral philosopher, not an economist, who objected to this aspect of free markets. Also, it refers extensively to the political power of corporations and the important role of the state as a regulator. So Adam Smith's widely mischaracterized in this field. However, he did, at the end, reach the conclusion that each individual working for his or for her economic self-interest would contribute to the well-being of the society as a whole, and this is what he referred to as the invisible hand that adjusts market mechanisms, and as a Protestant philosopher, one can only conclude that he meant the hand of God in that effort. Now, there's been much other work in this area. First of all, elite networks that impact policy decisions, partly by people's rotation in and out of prominent positions in government, and C. Wright Mills and Bill Domhoff have studied that process extensively. Also, this rotation in and out of government means that executives and government officials may agree rather than disagree on many of the principles that guide their work. Max Weber in The Protestant Ethic referred to financial success in the worldly realm as an indicator of divine election and eventual just rewards in heaven, as a primary motivator for economic behavior under capitalism. The tensions generated by religious values as a motivator and material rewards then become a marker of success in one's calling. So an interaction of religious and role of ideas with actual economic motivation. Then Marx and Engels have some critical work on non-material motivation in economic decisions, which is not usually the way that Marx and Engels are characterized either. That is, that the consciousness of entrepreneurs includes ideas about the moral purposes of their behavior that mask and legitimate the underlying material relations of economic production and elides or erases the gap between managers' values and the realities of business. So there are a set of ideas largely tied to religion that are motivating the managers of capitalist enterprises, and that's to demystify the elements of this legitimating ideology then became a key component of the Marxian critique. More recent approaches have talked about the business creed, and this is a very interesting book that was published in the late 1950s by Francis Sutton and others. It talks about the non-economic motivations of corporate executives in really what he refers to and this group as a creed, a quasi-religious set of beliefs that motivate behavior. Herbert Simon referred to what he called satisficing behavior, that is, the behavior by executives that does not act in the purpose of profit maximization, but rather other goals. In behavioral economics, there's now extensive work on the ethical and ideological components of decisions by executives. And then more recently, an emphasis in the business literature on socially responsible decision-making by Rosabeth Kantor and others. And finally, Pierre Bourdieu's emphasis on actual practices as opposed to economic models, the social construction of markets that occurs in his extensive work on housing markets, and that this activity rests partly in his earlier theoretical treatment of habitus, practice, field, and forms of capital that are not necessarily economic. And Bourdieu argues that executives seek to accumulate social capital, which includes symbolic elements like honor, prestige, and attention, in addition to profit. So, and how does all this relate to healthcare? Well, despite extensive research on managed care, the specific ideas and values that motivate executives in managed care organizations and other large insurance companies actually remain largely a black box. Much is attributed to executives, but there's remarkably little work on actually studying how its executives are thinking. So in our prior work, we theorized that that policy decisions of executives often reflect social constructions of reality concerning market processes in health and mental health services. They may employ a symbolic language linked to economic and political interests of organizational stakeholders, and that such constructions don't necessarily involve profit maximization. So the research questions that we had, and by the way, this I just wanted to point out, was piggybacked on a fairly large study of Medicaid managed care that was funded by the Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research. I've led a schizophrenic career in many ways in terms of applying for and getting a certain amount of funding for proposals that actually didn't say what I wanted to do, in fact, which in this situation was actually to study the decision-making of corporate executives, and we were lucky enough to be able to do that as part of a broader multi-method study, which I won't describe today in any depth. So the research questions were, what are the ideas and values about economic issues that motivate corporate and government decisions about Medicaid managed care? What are the ideas and values about non-economic issues that motivate corporate and government decisions? And how do CEOs and government officials perceive their roles and experiences in Medicaid managed care? And what we did is actually to conduct structured interviews with executives based on a pre-tested protocol, and this aimed to gain an understanding of their ideas, values, and experiences. The focus was that we tried to elicit their constructions of their own decision-making experiences rather than behavioral measures of decision-making. So it was what they thought about their own decision-making. In terms of the actual methods, all of the respondents occupied elite positions, and then those of us who had been on the planet the longest in our group actually solicited and conducted the interviews ourselves. The target populations was the CEOs of three managed care organizations, all for-profit, that obtained state contracts for Medicaid managed care, and also government officials who negotiated and monitored the contracts. We obtained interviews actually with the whole universe, as the small universe of people we targeted, all four CEOs. There was actually one managed care organization run by two CEOs, and all eight high-level state officials. Like going into dangerous neighborhoods, we decided that at least two of us ought to enter these folks' offices. On the average, each interview took about 90 minutes, and it was actually approved by our university's IRB. So in preparing interviews, responses for analysis, we took notes, I and my colleagues, extensive notes by hand or laptop. We tape recorded the interviews if they agreed. Verbatim quotes were edited slightly to enhance readability, and the identifying features were changed to protect anonymity. In the analysis, we did a series of iterative readings, line-by-line categorization of data into codes. The codes included such items as market share, employees, rate of profit, et cetera, et cetera. The coding process, we identified themes that recurred in the data and also themes that represented unusual or particular concerns. So just in terms of a few findings, first for the CEOs. First of all, we found that CEOs consistently expressed beliefs that emphasized the business creed, a set of beliefs, first of all, that emphasized social responsibility rather than necessarily profit-making. They talked about the organizational experience and resources to provide high-quality health services to the Medicaid population at a reasonable cost to the state, such quotes as, "We believe in managed care. We took the offensive. We saw a way to apply our organizational mission to improve the health status of people in the program. Also, our goals were to bring our expertise to the Medicaid population and to serve as a model in high-risk case management." Other areas of social responsibility were an emphasis on non-financial successes involving employees' job security and well-being. One of the CEOs said, we have about 700 people that work in the health plan. Probably 200 or 225 have their livelihoods, families, car payments, etc., tied up in the Medicaid program. It's not that we're making so much money. We're concerned about our employees. Quite different from what we expected, obviously. The next is that using Medicaid experience to enhance market share and systems for private managed care products, so that it wasn't the profitability so much in Medicaid as using the experience in Medicaid to go into the private sector services, that managed care would help the organization obtain a larger proportion of the market. Such quotes as, when we got into Medicaid, we didn't have quality coordination, customer service, et cetera. That helped build our company. Being in Medicaid managed care has made us a better organization, although it hasn't contributed significantly to our overall financial performance. And then they emphasized predictability versus the rate of profit, which is maybe our most surprising finding. Their rate of profit in Medicaid managed care, we determined after quite extensive interviewing, was about 1 to 3%, actually quite low rates of profit. They all confirmed this independently, and the state officials did as well. So then what were they doing in Medicaid managed care? Well, actually, it turned out that as for-profit corporations whose stock was sold on Wall Street, the rate of profit is actually less important than the predictability of financial performance. Investors and investment analysts evaluated a company's performance based on the rate of profit and also the management's ability to predict profitability over time. So as one CEO said, we're a privately held for-profit company. We've never paid a dividend, but Medicaid contributed to our appreciated stock value. We make about 3% profit margin in Medicaid. Another said our motives were altruistic, although we have to make money. And these are other quotes that I won't take the time to go through in depth. They give other reflections on how the predictability of profit was actually more important than the actual profit made. Regarding the falling rate of profit as payouts increase, this is, again, a concept that went back to Ricardo in classical economics and that was taken up by Marx, that is the falling rate of profit as an inherent contradiction within capitalism. And they pointed to that, too. The first year you do well, the reason is that providers haven't figured out how to bill, so a certain amount of bills never get paid. Then they figure out how to bill, so Medicaid managed care becomes less profitable. Visions of state policies. The corporate executives actually expressed mixed experiences in dealing with the Medicaid bureaucracy. On the one hand, they credited state administrators with a collaborative approach, and that's one quote I won't read. And then they also faulted the state administration for unpredictability, and this has to do with the rotating cast of characters in the governor's office, the changing views about behavioral health, partisan conflicts between Republicans and Democrats and the legislature and so forth. So the unpredictability they thought derived from politicians more than government officials who ran the program. Then regarding the officials of state government, about cost control and the rate of profit, they all emphasized that cost control in Medicaid was actually their paramount motivation. They viewed for-profit managed care organizations as key elements in their cost control strategy, and they referred to Medicaid as the main driver of state expenditures. And for instance, one manager said, under Medicaid managed care, we can manage the economics of the system. The same thinking also applies as to why we privatize prisons. So it has to do with cost control from their point of view. They all express unequivocal confidence that working with private corporations in Medicaid managed care facilitated cost control for state government as opposed to prior fee-for-service models. They also agreed that there were very limited opportunities for profit for the corporations working in Medicaid managed care, 1 to 3%, and they confirmed the executives' expectations that Medicaid managed care facilitated the corporation's efforts in private sector commercial interest insurance markets. They actually expressed more criticism of the legislators than any other group. They basically said that things like most of the legislators have basic ignorance about the program and unwillingness to learn. Some legislators believe that if managed care organizations are making any profit at all, that's wrong. And they finally said, regarding managed care organizations and their executives, they conceptualize their work as promoting capitalist market values. This is the head state official saying, that's what competition adds, it's capitalism.
Wonderful.
So in conclusion, we found actually quite substantial non-economic motivation in corporate decision making. The economic considerations emphasized issues other than profit per se, such as civic responsibility. The economic considerations did not focus on rate of profit only, which was actually surprisingly low. Instead, it facilitated other economic activities, such as their role in the commercial insurance sector. State executives generally confirmed the executives' point of view and expressed confidence in the participation of for-profit managed care organizations in Medicaid managed care. So these constructions actually represent a complex panorama of motivations in which profit maximization and financial self-interest comprise only a part. And just to go through this quickly, the ethical purpose in fostering market activities was actually emphasized en route to broader human betterment. So this does not necessarily categorize what executives do, but it does summarize how they view what they do. And this resembles some of the earlier studies that I talked about, such as Weber's work. Now, there were limitations of the study. These were actually regional corporations that were subsidiaries of international multinational corporations. And so the executives actually earned in the six-figure range a year instead of the seven- or eight-figure range, the corporate executives that run such their parent corporations, such as Cigna and Aetna, et cetera. So our findings don't necessarily generalize to the higher level managers of the multinational companies or to other regions, but actually based on other work in behavioral economics, we don't see any reason to expect that the CEOs and government officials who operate in other states or at the national level in the United States or even in other countries would express substantially different beliefs and perceptions. Now, they may not have depicted their actual views and experiences accurately, but actually, again, from our review of the economic literature, we're actually pretty convinced that CEOs operate on for a variety of motivations, of which profit is only one. So in summary, these patterns contradict some conventional wisdom about the profitability and economic self-interest in the motivation of executives. In contrast to images conveyed by critics and advocates, including ourselves, executives don't necessarily see themselves as emphasizing profit. They do express confidence in market mechanisms of capitalism for advancing the public good, and they have humanitarian ideals and ethical concerns that figure prominently in their consciousness. So we've seen corporate executives and state bureaucrats often as adversaries to needed health reform, but even if they are, perhaps we should examine more closely the complex beliefs and ideologies of the business creed that actually guide people. Thank you.